This message, titled The Tower of Babel, from Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 through 9, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com. Well, brothers and sisters, the only introduction that is needed this evening as we come to this Old Testament story is to simply state the truth of our passage as it stands so plainly. The Tower of Babel, this human endeavor that we read of in these verses, really serves as an everlasting memorial, a constant reminder to us of the tragedy of human pride. At Babel, we see that God counters humanity's best efforts at exalting self, and he brings them to nothing with a pronounced judgment that is so severe and so universal that it is only reversed through the gospel of Jesus Christ. And to that end this evening, I only have two specific points. And the first point will be this: man going up. We read in verse 4, "Then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens.'" And my second point this evening: man's going up and God's coming down. We read in verse 7, "Come, let us go down and there confuse their language." So the first thing that I want you to see from these verses this evening is man's going up. Man's going up. What's going on in Genesis chapter 11? Well, I need to give you a little bit of context to really understand what is happening. You remember, perhaps, that just before this chapter, in Genesis chapter 10, we have what is often called the Table of Nations. We see the development of the human race through the sons of Noah. But just before that, before chapter 10, we have the prolonged story in Genesis chapter 6 through Genesis chapter 9 of the great flood. You remember perhaps a couple of weeks ago when we gathered, we talked about Noah's flood. I preached on that great and tragic event. As God saw the sinfulness of humanity, he determines, he purposes to wipe out from the face of the earth all but 8 people whom he saved in the ark. And as the floodwaters subside, Noah and his family, we read in the 9th chapter of Genesis, come forth from the ark. God gives them the command to be fruitful and to multiply, that same command that he gave to Adam and Eve. They were to go forth and they were to do what Adam and Eve did not do. They were to go and, in a very real sense, begin humanity all over again. And we might think, we might wish, we might hope that Genesis chapter 9 ends on a happy note. We would love, because it's the kind of stories that we love, to have a happy ending. But if you remember what happens there at the end of Genesis chapter 9, we find that even Noah and Noah's sons continue in the downward spiral of sin. We see Noah, a righteous man, but a man with many faults, subdued by the fruit of the vine, and lying there drunk. We read that his son Ham comes and mocks him. And what we begin to see, even at the end of Genesis 9, even as God has brought this family safely through the floodwaters, is that the wickedness in the human heart could not be rooted out by the flood. Sin remains. Sin stays. Sin grows. Sin spreads. And it does so even with a strategic precision. And I want you to note that this evening, because it is a reminder to us that the sin in our hearts is so great that nothing outward can fully root it out. We sometimes think that. We want to think that if we just give more rules, if we just do this, if we just do that, if we say, do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, then we can address the real issues of sin. But we're reminded from the earliest chapters that sin is a problem of the heart. And ultimately what is needed is a changed heart. And that same sin that God had seen in the heart of man, we saw that in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. That even this great flood could not root that reality out. That's the context in which we now come to Genesis chapter 11. And we read in verse 2, and as the people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And we immediately need to think, okay, well, who are these people? Who are the people that are migrating from the east? Well, as Moses writes the book of Genesis to us, he wants us to know certain things about these people. And the first is that they are a sinful people. Who are they? Well, when we piece together some of what Moses gives here, it becomes plain who they are. If you look, for instance, in Genesis chapter 10, we see in verse 1, these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. And then we get the genealogy of each of these children. And we read that Ham, who is the son of Noah, fathers Cush and Egypt, Put and Canaan. We see that in verse 6 of chapter 10. And in verse 8, we find that Cush fathered Nimrod. And we are told in verse 8 of chapter 10, he was the first on the earth to be a mighty man. And in verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. In verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. So who are these people that are being referenced in Genesis chapter 11? Well, they are Nimrod. They are Nimrod and his family. And Nimrod is the son of Cush, and Cush is the son of Ham. And who was Ham? Well, I already alluded to it this evening. But in Genesis chapter 9, I hope you remember the tragedy of that man who mocked his father in a drunken stupor. And Noah, in Genesis 9, verse 25, curses the lineage of Ham. Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. The people that we read of in Genesis 11, who migrate from the east and begin to lay the foundations of this city, are, to put it very bluntly, a cursed family. They are a cursed family, and their settlement, this city that they seek to establish, becomes, in a very real sense, the epicenter of all ungodliness. It is not without purpose. It is not without vivid imagery that Babylon and the Babylonians become, in the Old Testament and even carried into the imagery of the New Testament in the book of Revelation, the great enemy of God's people. Often we see the city of Zion set in contrast to the city of Babylon. And these are who these people are. This is a sinful and cursed people. For the next thing that we see about them is not only that they're a sinful people, but they come up with a very sinful plan. Do you remember how the Apostle Paul, in Romans chapter 1, as he describes the life of people without God, do you remember the great detail he goes into to describe the unrighteousness of fallen humanity? In Romans chapter 1, verse 30, in a whole laundry list of things, Paul tells us that those who are without God become and invent ways of doing evil. That is something that we've preached from this pulpit before and will continue to do so, that the heart that is outside of the grace of God, the heart that is without God in this world, is a heart that loves to devise and to create and, as Paul says, to invent ways of doing evil. And we see that principle at work here in Genesis chapter 11. We see that happening here. We read that these people migrated from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And they begin to make bricks. And they begin to gather stones, and they begin to make mortar. And in verse 4, we read, "Then they said, 'Come.'" And here's their brilliant plan. Here's their sinful plan. "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly, so that," in verse 4, "we can build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." What is the plan of these people? Motivated by fear. You see that in verse 4. Here's the great reason they want to build this city and to build this tower. They say, "Unless we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." Motivated by fear, this sinful people wants to build a city with the hope of obtaining, we might say, a center of unity. They want to build a city that will hold sinful man together so that they won't be driven apart, so that they won't be driven away from one another. And that might, at first glance, you might say, well, what's so wrong about that? And in a very real sense, I want you to know that the desire for that kind of unity, it's not wrong. We were created for community. When God created us, he created us in his image, male and female, he created them. We are created for the purpose of community. We are not created for the purpose of isolation. That is not to bear the image of God. To bear the image of God, who is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, one God, three persons, existing together in communion with one another, we were created as image bearers of that triune God. We were created for community. And so from one sense, we look at that and we say, well, we understand that. We understand why they want to be unified. But here's the sin. Here's the fatal misstep that their hope of unity is misplaced. Their hope of unity is not found in God. They are a people who have no fear of the Lord. They are a people who, since the Garden of Eden, have been in one long progressive movement away from his presence. Rather than inquiring into the way to get back into the garden, to have fellowship with God, they are those who have turned their backs upon God. It is God who should be at the center. It is God who should be the high tower around whom they gather, God triune. But But they had rejected him. And in rejecting him, what we see in these verses so clearly is that they have to find something else to put at the center of their unity. And that something else is a city. It is a tower that they intend to build to the very highest, to the very top of the heavens. And I want you to know this evening, I want you to know that that is always the case. If God is not at the center, if God is not at the center of all things, sinful humanity will always find something else to unite us, something else to be at the very center. And we need to do the difficult work of asking ourselves the hard questions. What is at the center of this church? Because brothers and sisters, if it's not God, it is sinful. What is at the center of our families? Because if it's not God, we're no better than these people. What's at the center of our marriages? What's at the center of our parenting? What is at the center of our relationships? What is at the very heart of our homes and our lives, of our desires, of our wants, of our hopes, of our aspirations, of our dreams? What's at the center? Because that's the great sinful plan of these people. Sin ever seeks, to put it this way this evening, to decentralize God. Sin is not content with God at the center and God being the unifying factor around whom we gather. And it says, God, step aside. Something else has to stand in your place. And that is their plan. They say, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its tops in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the whole face of the earth. But the other thing that we see about these people, they're a sinful people with a sinful plan. But what we see in such clear writing is their sinful pride. It's not simply that they want a center of unity. But look at what they say in verse 4. Let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves. Let us make a name for ourselves. You see, in their conjoined effort, they not only seek to displace God, but you might think of it this way tonight. The foundation of the gigantic empire they want to build is in order to display the glory of man in independence from his God. Let us build a tower so we may make a name for ourselves. You know what they're actually saying when they say that? They are saying, let us build something. Something of such beauty. Something of such excellency. Something of such strength and dominion and power and glory that all the earth will stare with breathless wonder and say, oh, look, look at what mighty man has accomplished. And brothers and sisters, the root of that, this is so simple, this is so plain, this is so evident, but the root of that is the true character of pride. Pride seeks to make much of self. That's what pride does, and that's what they're saying. Let us do that. Let us glory in our pride. Let us glory in what we can do. Let us glory in our accomplishments. And they write their name, me, myself, and I, over all of it. Parents, can you imagine this evening? Or grandparents? If you were to go to your children and you were to ask them that first question of the Shorter Catechism, what is the chief end of man? Can you imagine if a child responded and said, man's chief end is to glorify himself and to enjoy himself forever? It would be a horrible answer that ought to cause our hearts shock and grief. And yet, if I can put it this way this evening, that is the Babylonian Catechism. Man's chief end is to glorify myself, that all the world may see that I have made a name for me, myself, and I. And without hyperbole this evening, it is a terrible sin. It is an affront to the God of all glory, whose name alone is to be revered and feared. It is a terrible sin. And it is also an exposing sin, because it reminds us that the smallest ounce of pride is enough to condemn forever. The smallest degree of pride that exists in our hearts is, apart from the saving grace of Jesus Christ, enough to condemn forever. Who is it that will not inherit the kingdom of heaven? Not only the sexually immoral. It's not only thieves. It's not only adulterers. It's not only homosexuals. It's not only murderers. But it is those who pride themselves in themselves. And Babel reminds us that that is always the direction of man without God. He builds up and up and up, and he goes up and he builds a monument to me, myself, and I. But secondly, this evening, I want you to notice not only man's going up, but God's going down. As Moses writes this story, there's really a hint of irony in what's being written. We have this picture of proud man. We have this picture of arrogant man who makes much of himself. And in almost a comical way, and I don't mean slapstick comical way, I mean Psalm 2 comical. Why do the nations rage? The Lord sits in heaven and laughs and holds the nations in derision. In that type of comical way, to use that expression, look at what Moses writes. In verse 4, then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And then what does Moses immediately add in verse 5? And the Lord came down. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And as if to add that jab one more time, in verse 7, God says, come, let us go down. And there really is a hint of irony in that. You know, I assume that on a summer day, most of you, all of us, have probably seen an anthill on the sidewalk. And And when you look at that anthill, it seems like something insignificant. I suppose you could lower yourself to their level and try to stare at that anthill, or you could try to look at that anthill from the perspective of an ant, and you might think, well, that's a pretty mighty big anthill. But then you stand up and you look down at it and you realize what an insignificant thing it really is. Well, if I can suggest it that this evening, that's really the imagery Moses is using. Here, mighty man has built a city, and he's building a tower that is intended to reach the very top of the heavens, and God has to come down to see it. As if to say, and as if to assert his dominion and his authority and his transcendence as the God who is over all things. As if to say, at this endeavor and this enormity of human pride, where is it? I've got to come down to your level to even see it for what it is. And what does God do? Well, he does two things in his going down. The first is what we might call an intervention. In verse 5, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. In verse 6, and the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. That's a verse that's caused some confusion. Well, what does God mean there? Does God mean that humanity in this concentrated effort, this prideful rebellion, does God mean that if something doesn't happen, they're going to become omnipotent? They're going to be able to accomplish all that they want to do, that they're going to be able to build their tower to the top of the heavens and so, in a very real sense, overthrow God? Well, it's not what God means. That word that we see in that verse, nothing which they propose to do will now be impossible for them, quite literally, and the older translations do a good job, it means nothing that they will do will now be restrained. There will be no restraint placed upon sinful humanity unless God himself intervenes. Many of you know in principle what that snowball effect is. Sometimes, especially when it's very sticky snow, you can begin to roll a snowball on the ground and it just keeps growing, it keeps gathering, it keeps building. And that illustration is helpful to think about the very character and the nature of sin. What God is saying is the sin and the sinful imaginations of these people who find all kinds of ways to invent evil, their sin needs to be restrained. Because if it is not, it will never stop. If it is not, it will never be hindered. It will never be calmed. It will never be subdued. They will never yield for an instant. The sin will grow and grow and grow, and it will yield fruits of unrighteousness of unimaginable proportions. And it stands there for us, brothers and sisters. Do you fear sin? Do you fear the smallest inclinations of sin in your heart? I know I don't nearly enough. But what this stands to remind us of is the hardness of sin. How hard it makes our heads, how hard it makes our hearts. That unless God himself intervenes, unless God himself stretches forth a restraining hand, sin will run its full course. Why is it that every niggling doubt in our hearts does not immediately yield to atheism. It's because God intervenes. Why is it that every lustful thought does not terminate in full-blown adultery? Because God restrains. Why doesn't every burst of outrage and anger in your life end in murder? Because God intervenes. Why doesn't every wayward thought come to a finish in full-blown rebellion? Because God restrains. Why is it that every illicit desire does not end with you robbing a store? Because God intervenes. God restrains. And that's what he is saying, let us go down. Because as they are united in their rebellion against me, unless a powerful and omnipotent hand will restrain even for a time and a season the sin of these people, it will never end. The restraining hand of God. And brothers and sisters, the day is coming when God will restrain sin no more. I think that's part of the graphic description that we get of hell. Jesus says, out there is outer darkness, where there will only be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. Condemned humanity, never having the restraining influence of God to stem the tide, and to hold back sin, but to remove that hand and give condemned humanity into the desires of their hearts, and sin will run its full course, and there will be nothing but the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. But in this day, God is a God who intervenes, who restrains. The other thing that God does is he inflicts. God comes down in a tremendous act of judgment. He cannot remain silent at humanity's pride. We might say that the construction on earth must be answered by destruction from heaven. And what we read and what we see is the way in which God inflicts judgment upon them. And what is sobering, you'll notice that the very judgment that God brings upon these prideful people is the very thing that they feared most. In verse 4, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. In verse 7, God says, come, let us go down and there confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. Verse 8, so the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth. And for emphasis, it's repeated in verse 9, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of the earth. That is God's great judgment upon their pride. That is what God inflicts upon this rebellious and sinful and prideful people. And I want you to hear in that sentence, I want us to hear it this evening, that God is declaring, here is how much I hate your pride. God hates pride. And it is a sin which is destined for the worst of God's judgments. And he comes. And in this tremendous display, He confuses their languages. And by so doing, he breaks apart their unity so that there is isolation and confusion and division and separation. And God doesn't do it with a battering ram. God doesn't do it with flame and fire. God doesn't do it with his heavenly armies raising the city that they've built. But he simply does it by confusing their language. In 1782, Congress, kind of the de facto motto that Congress gave to the United States, perhaps some of you know it, it's on the United States seal, it's on the back of our coins, E pluribus unum, from the many, one. But what we actually see, and what is true of humanity without God, what is true in the infliction of divine judgment that God gives here, not e pluribus unum, from the many one, but what we actually see is from the one, God makes many. And that may seem to you this evening to be a little thing. That may seem to be a bit of a strange judgment. How severe is that actually? You just confuse their languages. But I want you to call to mind this evening that it is not a little thing. Because what is the result of this? The result of divided languages is not a sign of human progression, but a memorial of sin. And languages, not to get overly sociological, but it's widely recognized that at the heart of every culture, at the heart of societies and nations, is language. And so as God confuses the languages in an act of judgment, the result of that is not unity, it is disunity. And in the history of humanity, it has, most of the time, bred nothing but hatred. Nation versus nation, kingdom versus kingdom, people versus people. The disunity of language is a disunity of the heart. And it is an awful punishment. And it is at the bottom, and it is at the root, and it is the source of the enmity and the hatred and the division that exists in the world today. It is the curse of Babel, and we still feel it. Humanity loves to hate each other. And we come up with all kinds, we find any excuse to hate our fellow man. And it's a result of the judgment that God brings against pride. As if to say, pride will never unify you. At the end of the day, all pride can do is tear you apart and tear you to shreds. But is this story intended to only end in tragedy? No. Because what it's doing for us, brothers and sisters, it is setting the scene for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because the gospel, we must always remember this, the gospel is the great and the single unifying factor of all people. The gospel is what unites us, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it is only found in the gospel. Or if I can put it this way this evening, the curse of Babel is only rolled back by the power of the gospel. You know, we see something of that, and I wish we had more time, but we see something of that in Acts chapter 2. As Jesus ascends to heaven, he sends his Spirit. The Spirit falls on the apostles, and what do? They speak in tongues. They speak in tongues. The tongues that once divided become the very means by which Jesus now proclaims the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ, his glorious gospel. It is the gospel that must be the unifying factor. And that is true until that glorious day that we read of in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9, when a people from every tribe and every language and every nation will gather before the throne of the Lamb to praise him with united voice. The curse of Babel can only be undone by the blessings of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And as we come to this story, it is intended to build in our hearts the anticipation when God himself will do what no man can. When God will do what no civil rights leader can. When God will do what no creed and no confession can. When God will do what no denomination can. When God will do what no nation and no president and no king and no laws will ever be able to do, and that is to truly make us one. Babel drives us to the gospel and to the glory of Jesus Christ. Let's pray.